day, and welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm your host, Stephen Henderson, and I'm really glad you've decided to join us. When you think about the 20th century, and in particular the second half of the 20th century after World War II, I think it's really easy to think about prosperity, economic growth. And there are really good reasons for that. From about the late 1930s to at least the 1970s, there was a real boom in America. The middle class expanded, home ownership grew, and the influx of money helped create one of the most famous music experiences here in Detroit in American history. For much of both America's and the world's history, economic progress always just kind of slogged along. We had a few inventions each year, but it was really hard to produce new things en masse and distribute them effectively. And then something really amazing happened. From 1870 to 2010, economic growth and inventions really exploded. But the years when people truly shared in these gains happened most prominently between about 1938 and 1973. Why then? Why did we turn our back away from the policies of that era? And why did growth halt so abruptly in 2010? And also, how do we get back to the kind of glorious years of this 1930s to 1970s window? Brad DeLong is an economic historian, and he was the Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury during the Clinton administration. He recently wrote about all this in a new book titled Slouching Toward Utopia, An Economic History of the 20th Century. And in it, he charts out why America and the world had so much prosperity in the 20th century, especially in the latter half. We want to both know why and also how to get back to that time after World War II when economic prosperity was not just abundant, but was more shared than at other periods in the United States. Brad DeLong, welcome to Detroit Today.
Thank you very much for inviting me to come on
here. Yeah. So I want to start here with you just kind of explaining why America and the West have had so much economic growth in the time period that I was just talking about. What was so special about that time, and how were we able to get beyond things like mass scarcity and other things that had held economic growth back?
Well, you know, I suppose the right answer is that we finally managed to hit the institutional sweet spot. You know, we'd had literacy, we'd had writing, we'd had cities, we'd had large-scale human organizations for a long time. We'd had a market economy, which is a very important way of crowdsourcing solutions to social problems by giving everyone an incentive to think of something productive and profitable to do. But, you know, all that did not really do it, did not push the rate of technological progress up to anything reasonable at all until around 1870, when modern science hit its stride and when we also got the industrial research lab, Nikola Tesla, Thomas Edison, and most importantly, their assistants, and also our modern corporations, so that once you had an invention, you could deploy it not just in one factory, but in multiple factories worldwide. Those things pushed worldwide the rate of human technological progress up from, say, the 1/20th of a percent per year, which is what we see before 1500, all the way up to the more than 2% per year we saw from 1870 to 2010. Mm-hmm. So that in that period, we got more economic growth in 2.5 years from 1870 to 2010, more technological change than humanity had gotten in any century before 1500.
Yeah.
And that made a huge difference.
So let's talk about the second half of the 20th century and what happens when the world stops being at war and people in all nations kind of concentrate more on inner growth What is it about that period in particular that not only creates a lot of prosperity, but also expands the range of people who benefit from it? I mean, I think even despite some lingering inequalities, structural inequalities, especially in this country, there's this growth that affects so many people and lifts so many lives out of poverty. Talk about that window of time.
Well, I suppose 1945 to 2010, when the best summary statistic is that the average adult height of humanity grows by about 2.5 inches between 1950 and 2010. That the average adult male goes from about 5'6" to 5'8.5". That in 1950, people were still worldwide, were still so malnourished that relative to the present norm, they were on average stunted, by 2.5 years. But by 2010, by 2010, that was over. By 2010, we were down to maybe 400 million people living in what the World Bank would call close to dire poverty, a state in which you spend several hours a day thinking about how hungry you are, and not because you're dieting. One in which material scarcity is the dominant form of your life, in that half or more of your resources have to go to your 2,000 essential calories plus essential nutrients, every day. And that world for almost all of us worldwide, fell away from 1950 to 2010, which was something that had never happened in human history before.
I want to talk about what happened and the way that dies in 2010. I think there were signs that it was slowing and cooling before that. But what is it that takes us away from that period and the benefits of that growth?
It takes us away from the period of rapid growth.
Yes.
That is how it is that after 2010 things stop.
Mm-hmm.
Well, first, there seems to be around 2010, maybe 2005, a great forgetting about lessons learned, about how to actually run modern market and scientific economies. That if you'd asked anyone in 1960 or 1970 or even 1980 or 1990, would the world find itself on the edge of another Great Depression? The answer would be hell no. That we learned in the 1930s and afterwards, how to stop Great Depressions. And the answer is that whenever the private sector stops spending, whenever the private sector sits down, then the government has to stand up one way or another. And, the central bank is the first thing that stands up. The central bank tries to goose the private sector into spending more. And then the second thing that happens is if that doesn't work, well, if the private sector has sat down and isn't spending enough to get jobs for everyone or nearly everyone, then the government has to stand up and the government, has to start spending. And has to start spending on a large enough scale to keep the economy at or near full employment. But only China did that after 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not supposed to know. They're communists. They're not supposed to know how to run a market economy. We are. And yet we didn't. Not in the United States, not in Western Europe, kind of, sort of, in Japan. The late Shinzo Abe, I think, did a good job. But a general loss of social knowledge about how to run an economy. And also, over the previous 30 years, my very smart neighbor Fred Block thinks one big thing that happened was that we'd had too much of a financialization of America's large corporations. And so we had hollowed out the great industrial research labs, the kind of GEs, the Xerox parks, and so forth. The private sector industrial research labs that had pushed a huge amount of technological progress forward in the years starting in World War II the big corporations decided those were really no longer things they really wanted to spend so much money on, since they could shut them down or slim them down and pay out more in the way of dividends and stock buybacks and win the applause of Wall Street. And Fred's view is that after 30 years of that, we'd finally eaten the seed corn. And so the engine of technological progress in America, but also in Western Europe, it's been firing on only four cylinders, on only half of its cylinders, mm-hmm. since 2005 or so, as best as we can tell. And that's made a big difference as well.
Yeah. Yeah. We're talking with Brad DeLong, who is an economic historian and former Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury during the Clinton administration. We're talking about a book he's written called Slashing Toward Utopia, an Economic History of the 20th Century. We're talking about the growth of economic prosperity and shared economic prosperity, especially in the second half of the 20th century, why that has slowed significantly here in the early 21st century, what we do about that, and how we think about the levers we need to pull to get back to a time when growth was more certain. We'd love to hear from you during the conversation as well. Call and tell us what you make of the economy these days, what you make of the government's attempts to get the economy going, to make sure that there is shared prosperity. Are we doing the right things? Think about the era that we're living in as well, the era of the tech boom and the tech boom billionaires. Is that era making it harder to share in prosperity? Why is that true? And what do we do to make sure that does not return us to a much darker time in our past? 313-577-1019 is always the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can include you in the conversation that way. Brad, I want to talk a little about the work that you did during the Clinton administration and what happened during the Clinton administration. I mean, that really is the last era of this profound growth and the spread of that growth among lots of people, a really diverse profile of Americans who benefit. The rates of home ownership, for instance, go absolutely sky high during the 90s. We get to a level of employment that people hadn't really imagined before. And at the same time, we pay down an enormous amount of the nation's debt. Talk about what was happening then that allowed that to happen, and then again, why it kind of so abruptly stops, not just with the election of George W. Bush, but into the next decade, the problems that surface. But as someone who was part of the Clinton administration, I'm really curious about internally how all of that hatched and how it was guided.
Well, the Clinton administration came in wanting to do lots of things. First of all, and I suppose from our perspective, the most important thing is that Al Gore wanted to start getting ready to deal with global warming. Mm-hmm. So that, when global warming really did start to hit a generation or so after 1990, it wouldn't be so bad that dealing with global warming would kind of eat up all of the technological dividend humanity would expect normally to get from improved science and technology between 2020 and 2050. And I think we came within one vote in the United States Senate of actually getting the policies to start putting global warming under serious control. Al Gore's BTU tax. It was Senator David Boren from Oklahoma who was the public face of the opposition. But there were 43 Republican senators who wouldn't go along with it. There were, practically every single Ohio Republican politician now in office wouldn't go along with it. And there were seven Democrats headed by David Boren from Oklahoma. He was the public face, plus maybe a couple of others. And so we didn't do it. And so now we're finally starting to do it. But, you know, you can look out at your sky right now. Mm-hmm. You can see the start of the process. And indeed, from 2020 to 2050, global warming and dealing with the excessive heat we're getting worldwide, that is going to eat up much, if not all, of the technological dividend in terms of increased wealth we would normally expect to get from better science and technology over the course of the next generation. Hmm. It's kind of too late to stop the damage from 2020 to 2050. But maybe if we act now, and if we act much more swiftly than we are, we can greatly limit the damage, additional damage, that'll come between 2050 and 2080. So there was the attempt to get in front of this problem. Yeah, but that ship has sailed. There was also a desire to do lots of other things, to change from the America of Universal High School, which we had created during the Progressive Era, to an America of, universal some college, or at least some post-high school apprenticeship training programs, as something that every American got as virtue of their status as a citizen, in order to level them up so that they could compete in the modern post-industrial economy. There was the desire to get national health care. And again, the votes, we found out, although we thought we'd had lots of Republican partners thinking these were good things to do, when the chips were down, they followed Newt Gingrich and his lieutenant John Kasich, and their view was that it's much more important to portray the Democratic president as a failure so we can win the 94 election than to deal with America's problems, and then we can deal with America's problems afterwards. They were right that it was very good politically for them to spend 2 years talking about how Bill Clinton was a failure in 93-94. Afterwards, they had no ideas at all about how to deal with America's problems when they got into power. Yeah. And, those of us who are actually trying to deal with America's problems in 93-94 still strongly resent them. And then there were the other things, the things where Clinton was actually able to get majorities. And the biggest of that was the large deficit reduction bill and the North American Free Trade Agreement. Deficit reduction, the idea was we reduce the deficit, we raise taxes on the rich, we constrain the growth of government programs. We're actually quite mean to America's poor in terms of cutting back on the resources the government's funding to them. And the hope was that if we reduced the government deficit, that money that otherwise would have gone to buy government bonds would go into the private sector, and we'd get a faster productivity growth, high investment, high wage growth economy. And, with the assistance of Alan Greenspan at the Federal Reserve, who was then seriously interested in solving America's problems, I think the only Republican office holder in the country who was back then, it worked. And we got wonderful years. Wonderful years all the way up until I suppose the year 2000. But, the fact that that was only one third of what Bill Clinton had hoped to do. And then there's also the great NAFTA imbroglio. How it was supposed to give Mexico a position to grow rapidly as an export platform for...
Okay, we're gonna take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Brad DeLong about economic prosperity. You also want to get going with you, the listeners, on the phones and on social. 313-577-1019 is the number. Call and tell us what you think is the key to economic prosperity in the 21st century. What do we do about the tech boom and the inequality that it's highlighted and opened up? What do we do about labor and the struggles that we're having with labor right now. Not just making sure people have good wages, but making sure that people even want to participate in the labor market. All of the things that seem to be inspiring uncertainty right now, how do we turn them around? 313-577-1019 is the number. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today. We'll include you in the conversation. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today. This is Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, your host, and I'm really glad you decided to join. We're talking right now with Brad DeLong, who is an economic historian, former assistant secretary of the U.S. Treasury during the Clinton administration. He's author of a recent book titled Slouching Toward Utopia, an Economic History of the 20th Century. We're talking about the ways that prosperity has fallen off to some degree in the early parts of the 21st century, the prosperity that we built largely in the second half of the 20th century after the Second World War, the incredible boom and the incredible spread of that economic prosperity across many different profiles and demographics here in the United States. How do we get back to that era? What are the things now that are standing in the way of prosperity? We want to hear from you as well on the phones and on social. Colin, let us know what you make of our economic woes and problems right now and what you would maybe do differently. Talk to us about the tech boom and the things that we're seeing it highlight in terms of problems in our economy. 313-577-1019 is the number. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we can work you into the conversation. Brad, I want to have you talk just a little about tech in particular and the consolidation of wealth that we see largely because of tech. I think everybody acknowledges that that is an impediment to shared prosperity. What do we do about it? What would your approach look like to the almost monopolistic dynamic that we see from things like Twitter and Google and Amazon, Facebook? What kind of problem does that pose to prosperity?
I suppose the first thing to say is that the modern info-biotech economy we're moving into is one that is a lot less friendly to kind of the market economy systems that we really have been running with. Oh, wow, that we've been running with since 1600, since the age of the commercial imperial revolution. On the grounds that a market is an absolutely wonderful way of helping people figure out how to crowdsource solutions to problems of production. When people are producing things that require a lot of energy and effort and materials to make an individual copy of, and ones in which the importance of intellectual property and of network effects is not salient. But we're moving away from an economy in which, it's simply the work and the materials and the energy and the processing that is the important source of value, into a world in which it is the relationships and the experience and the knowledge and the information and the intellectual property that is the thing that is truly the creator of greatest value. And the market economy does not do that well.
Mm-hmm.
Because the overwhelming incentives are no longer to become a better producer, but instead to find a way to erect some very large and complicated, durable and deep and wide moat around what you do so you can cream off an awful lot of profits from it. I guess we really saw this first in the days of Microsoft and the PC,
mm-hmm.
when only Microsoft and Intel, of all the corporations and all the pieces of the value chain involved in making personal computers, got rich. But they got fabulously rich because they were at the choke point. And ever since then, we've had an increasing recognition by the companies that acquire substantial positions in high-tech markets that the key thing is to find a way to become one of the choke points and then to turn every other piece of the value chain into a commodity. And that's how you get really, really rich. And it is a remarkable success for the shareholders and to some degree for the engineers of the companies that win, right? That Apple Computer is now worth, what, $3 trillion or so on the stock market, while GM is hanging out there at $50 billion. And, you know, Apple Computer is the only one making cell phones that's making any serious money. But, you know, that focus on figuring out how to commoditize your partners in the value chain's roles and how to preserve your moat, it's not one that is good for the economy or for its rate of economic growth in the long run. And that is the world we've managed to land ourselves in as we move to the infobiotech economy. And we need better ways of figuring out how to manage economy as it moves into a new configuration than we have now. You know, and God knows Lena Khan at the FTC is trying hard to think of some. But, you know, that's a small staff, and as of yet, we do not have that many terribly good ideas.
Yeah, yeah. Again, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. Let's go to Pete in Detroit. Pete, welcome to the show.
Hey, I was calling in. I'm interested in the topic. I think one of the things that we're missing here is the inventions of the past when the conversation started, you know, inventing the electrical light and the automobile. Those were inventions that helped everybody get a job, particularly the undereducated. Today's inventions don't do anything to help the undereducated. They help only the educated knowledge workers. So if you want to really improve things, you have two directions to go. Either educate your workforce more completely or find some inventions that will help those people continue to have good jobs. Thanks, and I appreciate your show.
Yeah, Pete, I really appreciate the call. Brad, what's your take on what Pete has to say there?
You know, there always are two ways that new technology can go. It can substitute for labor. You know, it can take jobs that humans used to have and remove them by providing some way to root yourself around what the human used to do. Or it can make the individual human more productive and more valuable to their potential employer. And what it is, what actually happens, is a very fine balance. You know, the one thing you can bet is that if big corporations with large market shares are in the business of driving invention forward, well, then what they're going to want to do is they're going to want to find ways in which they can weaken worker power and substitute for workers. Because if the inventions they pursue make workers their complements, their complements to technology and workers, then they give their workers more bargaining power at the next union wage negotiation or whatever. And so much of what the company spends its money on in terms of pushing technology forward winds up going immediately to higher wages for its workers. And the company's very much going to want to not craft inventions to push in that direction.
Yeah. Yeah.
That means we need to double down, I think, on government support of technological development. You know, the National Institutes of Health, the National Bureau of Standards, you know, the Commerce Department, they're the only institutions that can fund lots of R&D without having this desire to put their finger on the scales to make sure that the R&D is produced. Substitutes for labor rather than complements for labor. The problem with all of this, though, is that government organizations are inherently bureaucratic and risk averse, because in all bureaucracies you tend to be blamed for what went wrong. rather than praised for what went right. So here we have a problem we've been unable to resolve. We really need institutions other than large oligopolistic corporations with their industrial research labs, which they're really not funding on a large scale these days anyway, to push technology forward. But we don't really have a good idea about what they are or how to stand them up. We thought for a generation that the Silicon Valley venture system might be a good substitute. But, you know, we look at Silicon Valley venture capital in the age of social media and crypto bubbles, and that does not look nearly as good. That does not look satisfactory either. So it's a problem we have not resolved. You know, again, we're moving into the age of an infobiotech economy, and we truly do not know what kinds of societal, econo-social, political software we should be building to run on top of the new hardware of the new technology economy we're moving into in order to make it not crash.
Yeah. Okay, Brad DeLong, economic historian. Really great to have you here on Detroit Today to talk about your book, Slouching Toward Utopia, An Economic History of the 20th Century. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Okay, we are going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the intersection between art and activism, some really high-profile examples that we have seen recently, one on the really positive side, another on more of a negative side. Kim Trent, who is a Detroit-based activist and communications consultant, will join us to talk about it. We'll also continue to hear from you on the phones and on social. 313-577-1019 is the number. You can go to Twitter and hashtag us as well. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.